Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process and their job. My guest this week is the ESPN writer, as well as broadcaster, Ramona Shelburne. You know her as an NBA insider and a senior writer for ESPN. She's done some terrific long-form work, and you've also seen her, obviously, reporting on the NBA and appearing on various ESPN shows. As a part of this podcast, along with some of Ramona's other long-form pieces, we really get into her reporting on Ronda Rousey and what she found interesting about one of the more interesting people in sports today.
I went to the fight and I listened to her, and just in reading about her and preparing to cover it, I realized that I wasn't really interested in her as a fighter. I was interested in her as a female athlete.
We'll also talk about some of Ramona's other pieces, including an unbelievable piece of reporting on Lamar Odom's spiral, where Ramona drove in the middle of the night to a Nevada brothel to interview those at the brothel who were really taking care of Lamar Odom at essentially the most down point of his life. That was a pretty fascinating and not easy story to write. We'll ask Ramona Shelburne about being recruited to be part of The Vertical, which she ultimately turned down to stay at ESPN. We will talk about the transition from writing to being on television and what that entails, as well as some other stuff, including playing college softball at Stanford with Jessica Mendoza. All that and more coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Let's go to Ramona Shelburne in Los Angeles. All right, guys, let's take a moment to talk about sleep. Maybe you've already fallen asleep from this podcast. Let's hope that hasn't been the case. But Casper is a sleep brand that has created one perfect mattress that is sold directly to consumers. No commission-driven, no inflated prices. I read about these guys in the New York Times. Pretty interesting company in 2015. So they're really doing excellent stuff. And they have this award-winning sleep surface they developed in-house, sleek design, and is delivered in an easy-to-get, small-sized box. In addition to the mattress, they also offer adaptive pillows and soft, breathable sheets. How do they do this? Well, an in-house team of engineers at Casper have spent thousands of hours developing this mattress. They have combined in supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that has the right sink and just the right bounce. If you go online, you will see that there are thousands and thousands of reviews for Casper. They're basically sitting at close to a 5-star rating, and that's based on Amazon reviews, Google reviews, and Casper. So you'll see people who totally vet this product. Free shipping and returns to the United States and Canada. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. It is a product designed, developed, and assembled in the USA. If you're in the market for a mattress, listen up. You get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/Richard. The promo code is Richard. Let me give you the website again. www.casper.com/Richard. That is the promo code, RICHARD. Once again, www.casper.com/Richard. That's promo code Richard, RICHARD. Terms and conditions apply. All right, we bring in Ramona Shelburne, the fine ESPN writer. She is in Los Angeles, kind enough to get up pretty early. She's had a long weekend flying back from Oklahoma City to cover the Warriors-Thunder game, which was pretty interesting drama, even with the beatdown that the Warriors gave the Thunder. And she joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I should say it's afternoon here in New York, Ramona, but good morning to you in LA.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting working on the West Coast for like a world that really runs on East Coast time is that, and I also am a night owl on West Coast time, so that I frequently would be like the girl who's up, like when Buster Olney starts tweeting in the morning, like that's usually when I know it's time for me to go to bed. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to like change my whole approach at some point. Like Shelly Smith was one of the people who finally drove this home for me, and she was like, Ramona, it's Los Angeles, but the rest of the world is on Bristol time. So I've sort of found a way to change things up. Sometimes it's almost like being like a basketball player. You take naps during the day, but you get up early enough to check emails in the morning.
Ronan, here's where I want to start. There was a New York Magazine piece last year titled "Ramona Shelburne is beating male sports writers at their own game." How did you feel about that headline and the story?
Yes, I mean, it was a little loud for my taste, but I thought the story was, I mean, one, it's really weird reading about yourself, and it's really weird to see your picture in the paper, because, right, we're the ones who write it, so it's weird being on the other side of it. I haven't really been on the other side of it since I was in like high school and college, and I was a college softball player, and like the Stanford Daily would run a quote, right? So it was kind of a strange experience to be back on the other side of it. I think I actually like called my husband and said, "Hey, will you just read this to make sure before I do, because I'm kind of embarrassed, and just make sure there's nothing in there I'm going to hate." And so he read it, and he's like, "No, I think you'll like the story. There's nothing in there you're going to hate." And then I read it, and I was like, I thought the writer did a really good job after we had a long conversation about a lot of different things. So I didn't really know where he was going to go with it. But it was really strange being on the other side of the spotlight, because normally as a writer, you're just telling other people's stories and you connect on that level.
You've done a lot of long form pieces. Kobe Bryant, Ronda Rousey, I think probably people who listen to this podcast have read. But the piece, at least recently, that stayed with me the most that you did was on Lamar Odom's sort of spiral and descent. That had quotes and anecdotes and reporting from brothel employees. It was probably one of the darker pieces, I would imagine, that you reported. I want to ask you about your approach to feature writing, but within that, can you take the listeners through the reporting of that kind of piece, which is, you know, you're delving into things that you are not normally delving into at an NBA game?
Man, that story really got to me. Because I went out, I knew I was going to write it. I mean, I knew Lamar from when he played with the Lakers. I'd done a few stories with him earlier in my career, and I knew him pretty well. And I had actually talked with my editor at the time, Eric Neal, about doing a story before he had overdosed, right? I knew he had been spiraling. I knew he was not in a great place. And I had sort of been looking for him and checking in on where he was and what was going on with him even before this all happened. I think the sense we all had was something was going to happen because he was spiraling in a bad way. And so then when we got the news, I was actually at an ESPNW conference down at Dana Point, and it was like really surreal, because I remember there was this like happy female empowerment conference going on, and I was up really late at night one night on the phone with just people who had been in Vegas at the hospital there, reacting to the news, but also like trying to find out how Lamar was. Like, I remember being on the phone with Rick Fox, and he was in Vegas, I think, for the Lakers preseason game, and he didn't know what to do. He was just so upset. He's like, "Should I go to the game? Should I go to the hospital?" And I was like, I remember saying to him, "Rick, I don't know, but I don't even know what hospital he's at, but it sounds really bad. Like, the initial reports sound really bad." And he goes, "Well, if you find out what hospital he's at, will you tell me?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think I can do that." I mean, it's sort of weird where you become this, it's not even a story anymore. There's a human being involved, and there's men who played with him and are friends with him who really care about him, who are hurting. And Rick actually like went to the hospital, and the Lakers went to the hospital after their preseason game, which was just at UNLV a little ways away. And people I spoke with that night, I was really late at night. I think it was maybe 2 or 3 in the morning. They didn't think he was going to make it. I mean, they left the hospital and had felt like they had to say goodbye, because they didn't feel like he was going to make it at all. Like, if he woke up, he would probably have severe brain damage. And it was horrible to just watch this unfold and see these guys really hurting. And I remember that night, like I voiced an essay that, you know, to try to put it in perspective on SportsCenter the next day. And it was sort of this idea, like, if he died, it was, you know, we had to have something ready to go. So then you go from that horrible, horrible night. And I think I reported a little during the next day, and what was going on. And then we all kind of just said, all right, I'm going to have to leave and go to Vegas. And it was very strange because, like, I think I was hosting one of the panels that day, so I had to wait until after the panel was done. And so that night, booked a flight the next morning to go to Las Vegas and then spent some time reporting. And I remember saying to my editor on the story, well, how do I report this? I just stand outside the hospital and see what happens, and then we'll go from there. And he goes, and, you know, Eric, my editor, had said, I think you need to go and find out where he was and what happened that night. I said, maybe I should go to the brothel. Maybe I should find out where it is and see if any of them will talk. And so once I got to Vegas, I figured out where the brothel was. There was a couple other reporters who'd been out there. But it was a strange story, Richard, because, like, the brothel, you know, they had an interest in telling their side of it because they obviously didn't look very good. You know, that this happened at their establishment, and prostitution is legal in the state of Nevada, except in two counties, right? So it's not legal in Las Vegas. You have to, and I think Carson City. Those are the only places where they don't have brothels. But the rules that govern it say you can't have you can't have drugs. They have to be tested every week. And so the brothel owner and the people working there had an interest in sort of telling their side of the story and say, I don't know where he got the drugs. It wasn't from us, right? That was their interest in it. And so they were trying to be very open about what happened that week, and they invited media. Plus, I think they, you know, there was a selfish motive in terms of getting all that attention for themselves. And so I just, you know, I said, okay, I guess I got to go where the store was. What happened? Where did it happen? And I found out the brothel was about an hour and a half away, which I guess I don't know what I was expecting, but I certainly didn't think I would be driving an hour and a half into the desert. But it was late. I think I left at like 5 Vegas time and got there around 7 PM. And you start driving out there and realizing how far into the desert you're driving. I'm not gonna lie. I was a little scared. I kind of thought about, should I be going out here by myself at night? This feel like a good idea. But I kind of kept going and, you know, you sort of don't know what you're going to get. And when I showed up there, there was another camera crew there, and they were filming some stuff there. And I was talking to the general manager, and it was desolate, you know, in and around there is to understate it. I mean, there's like, you know, if my car would have broken down there, you know, and there's no cell phone service, like, and I would have been walking for quite some time. And so you're out there, and it's a little scary, and it's a little, you know, you're kind of wondering why anyone would come all the way out here. And I realized at that point that was the story. Like, why did Lamar Odom, a guy who had so many people who cared about him, who had been trying to help? I remember being on the phone with Luke Walton, and Luke Walton said, you know, I've been trying to get a hold of him. I've been trying to just talk to him for the last year or two. See if I can help, if there's a way we can connect. And I'm like, why would a guy like this with so many people who loved him, who cared about him, who were trying to help him, why would he drive out into the middle of the desert to come to a place like this? And then, I figured, well, the only people to ask are the people who work there and the people who were there that night. And the women who were working there, I mean, they'd been through the ringer too. I mean, they had, In as much as you could connect in a way over, you know, 3 or 4 days that he had been staying there, they felt horrible about what happened. They had connected to him. They liked him as a person. He, you know, the woman who ran the place was in her 50s, and she was telling me how much he opened up to her in the car ride out there and in the days that she had been looking after him. And you kind of realize that, you know, why does he feel more comfortable opening up to these women he's never met who are being paid to hang out with him and do other things, obviously? Why does he feel more comfortable out here talking to them than he does talking to friends and former teammates who genuinely know him and love him? And I stayed and I just kept talking to them because that was the central question of the story.
Ramona, I think for young sports journalists, they'd be interested in this. When you first arrive at the brothel, What's the first thing you do? How do you sort of walk in there and say, I'm a reporter from ESPN and I'd like to talk to all of these people? That's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, it helped that I wasn't the first one through the door, right? There had been other, because I had sort of a day behind a lot of other people who had gone out there, a lot of TV crews that had been out there already. So it helped because I didn't feel super exploitative, right? I didn't feel like I was the first one through the door there. And maybe it helped them too because they had sort of done enough, they had done a few interviews. But what I recognized, and it sort of helped me, I think, do this story because it was late. Like I said, it was really late. I think it was maybe like 7:30 by the time I got out there. It was dark. This is like October. And the Keller camera crew that was there was just sort of wrapping things up. And so I was glad that they were still there because it would have been really weird to be the first one through the door, right? Like I was the only one out there. So anyway, they stayed for about an hour and I talked to the general manager about some things. And it was kind of, you know, like I felt kind of weird going through there, but I think I'd emailed somebody before. I can't remember the lady's name, but I just remember being, feeling a little weird, like sending this email to like whatever her first name was at bunnyranch.com. is this really what I'm doing right now? I guess it is. But she wrote back and said, yeah, come on out. And I remember telling my editors, I'm going to go. So I had an introduction and they knew I was coming. It wasn't like I just knocked on the door. The beginning part of this was like very surreal, right? It's not like I've ever been to a brothel before. So I didn't even know what this to expect. I walk in and I remember the guy, there was a man who greeted me at the door and walked me in and we're sitting on the couch and he's sort of describing to me the process, the thing that would happen when a client comes in and he says, well, you know, you'd meet the girls and then you'd have a conversation and then the girls would go in the other room and I'd come in as the general manager guy running the thing. And I'd say, you know, is there anyone you want to talk to further? And so I'd go get whichever girl he liked or whatever the client liked and bring them back into this room. And then they would privately negotiate what he would want and and what they would pay. And it's all a private negotiation between the client and whichever girl that he's chosen. And I go, and where would that happen? Where would that negotiation happen? And the guy says, oh, right here. Like, we'd sit on the couch. And I was like, oh, man, this same couch I'm sitting on right now. I just remember at this moment, like feeling like this is okay. This is what tonight's going to be. It's just a series of like, I can't overreact to anything that's happening and have any kind of judgments and have any kind of, I'm not comfortable here because this is what they do. This is their profession. And this is legal in the state of Nevada. And I remember kept having this idea of, just play it straight, just play it cool and talk to people like they're people.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I always try to do. And then later, the general manager actually left. The man who was running the place left. The camera crew left. I think it was maybe CNN might have been there. And I met the woman who had been, I think her name was TJ Moore. I still remember it. And she was the one who had picked Lamar Odom up in Las Vegas and driven him out there. And we started talking and I just kind of said, you know, take me through what happened that day. What do you remember? She started telling me and I could tell like she was really nervous and nervous is not the right word. She'd really been through the ringer. She'd really like the last couple of days, this was really hard on her. So we started talking and I realized this was the woman who knew what happened. This was the woman who I needed to know everything about what happened that night. And she seemed like she wanted to talk. Like she seemed like, you know, it wasn't about needing vindication or needing to defend anything. She wasn't going to try to spin me. Like I honestly felt like she just needed someone to listen to her because she'd been through a lot. I mean, as we were doing the interview for hours and hours and hours, I was there talking to her and some of the other people who were at the Bunny Ranch. The phone's ringing the whole time, and it's people prank calling. It's people prank calling the brothel, right? And some of them are pranks, and some of them are mean, and some of them are a little scary. And it was like the whole time this is happening, I'm just like, I have to just be cool. I have to just keep talking to them because I certainly, you don't come to a brothel and start judging people, right? You don't come there and make, you know, decisions about, you know, what happened. You just listen. And it was surprising how, once the cameras were gone, how much people just really wanted to talk.
Mentioned that Kobe is a long form piece. You did Rousey was one. Uh-huh. Obviously, you did Lamar. That was sort of driven by the sort of the news cycle or the elements of what happened mm-hmm. to Lamar. But are there certain figures that you are attracted to when you decide to do a long form piece, or are a lot of these pieces that you've done dictated by ESPN or an editor?
I think it's mostly I choose my subjects, right? I mean, sometimes it's the news moment, of course, right? Like the Lamar story, that was a news moment. And you know, I'd already kind of been interested in it. But, I remember having this conversation with Eric, my editor, once, pretty early on when I was at ESPN. And I said, you know, I'm always seem to be drawn to certain types of figures. And it's people, I'm always drawn to athletes or whoever it is who are either great or trying to be great. And then I just want to know how they do it. I just want to know why they do it, what's driving them and pushing them. And he said something like, you know, I think we all kind of write the same story over and over again. right? Like we're all sort of drawn to these certain types of stories, because at least for me on long form, when I do, when I write, like I get a little method on it. I get really into the story and I don't know if it's a little bit crazy, but I like to ask the people I'm writing about sort of the types of music they listen to and the movies they watch. And then I try to watch them, and what books do they read? I try to read them, or I try to just really inhabit like who that person is, or at least feel who that person is or connect to it. And I don't know if that's something in me that I'm trying to figure out how to be great myself, or I'm trying to figure out what the motivation is. Cause you know, we all day in and day out, right? That's just a constant, you know, what am I doing this for? What's pushing me? Right. We all have a job. You have a contract. You can just sit back and do it. Right. But in order to push yourself and in order to make something truly great, like you have to dig a lot deeper. And I don't know, maybe that's why I'm drawn to those stories about Kobe or Rhonda, or I used to write about Blake Griffin a lot earlier at ESPN, and other folks along the way. I've written a lot about the Warriors too. Steve Kerr is a sub. I think I've done maybe two or three stories on him. Steph Curry, just that team and sort of how it's connected and how they've sort of found a way for the parts to elevate the whole. That's always interesting. And maybe that's why I choose those types of stories. And then of course there's always just this, I'm always sort of drawn to any story that goes, whenever a story goes viral, there's a reason why. And it's usually because it taps into something that's going on in society that just we as a country or a society or whatever it is are sort of working through ourselves. And that would be probably the Donald Sterling stuff. That was one of the stories that I remember. I remember at that moment, it was really kind of the first time athletes had spoken up that loudly against an owner and on big social issues. I remember LeBron James was the first guy to say, there's no place for Donald Sterling in this league.
Right.
And nowadays we hear stuff like this all the time, but that moment was a real watershed moment, at least for me in covering professional sports. And like that galvanized that whole story forward and took it to another level, to the point where I just said, once I was in it, I was seeing that story all the way through the end.
I want to read you something that one of my guests on a previous podcast, a guy named Luke Thomas, he's a senior editor for MMA Fighting and mm-hmm. SiriusXM, and he covers MMA or has covered it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about Ronda Rousey. And he said this while praising you and saying he had great respect for you as a writer and reporter, but it was very interesting. And I mm-hmm. wanted to get your take on her. So he was saying that, in fairness to Ronda Rousey, she still fulfills an enormous, this is prior to her losing again, she still fulfills an enormous amount of media obligations both in and out of camp. She should frankly be commended for that. But she applies a different standard of what we'll tolerate in terms of questions when dealing with indigenous MMA media or MMA media that covers the sport every day. The dedicated mm-hmm. MMA fan base thinks as highly of Rousey as the rest of the wider world, but the traditional sports outlets talk about her as if it's real time hagiography. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right. They pick on her. I'm sorry. They pick up on none of her contradictions, problematic statements, or other areas of curiosity. She's under no obligation to speak to MMA media or answer our queries. But if all you know about Rousey is from what you read from non-native MMA outlets, there's a case to be made that you're getting a manufactured version of reality. And I think that was a direct comment to your long-form piece, which is probably the biggest long-form piece, at least in the written word, that we've read about Ronda Rousey. What's your what's your reaction to that? Do you feel like Rousey, not that you helped author a manufactured reality, but do you, was that story ESPNified, I guess would be my best way to phrase it.
Oh, wow. That's not how I thought you were going to phrase that. Because like, I don't think it's ESPNified at all. But I totally get what he's saying. Like I think it's, I totally understood where how did he phrase it? The native MMA press.
Well, yeah, she's applying a different, like a different standard of what she'll tolerate in terms of questions from those guys versus you, let's say.
Yeah, no, I get it. Like, I mean, I don't know, the stories with Ronda were really interesting for me as a reporter and a writer, because I the first fight I covered of hers was the Kat Zingano fight in Los Angeles, and I just remember I wasn't even interested in MMA. Like, I remember I liked boxing. My husband and I watched boxing together. That was one of the things, it's one of the sports we watch, and he's really into boxing, and so that was something I kind of have gotten into over the years. But MMA, I didn't like it as much, right? I guess, frankly, as boxing. And so, like, when ESPNW asked me if I'd cover the Rousey fight, and I said, oh, okay, it's in LA. Yeah, let me see what this is all about. And I went to the fight and I listened to her, and just in reading about her and preparing to cover it, I realized that I wasn't really interested in her as a fighter. I was interested in her as a female athlete. And so, you know, one of the things, Richard, I tend to do as I write is I know what I don't know, right? When I don't know something, when I'm not deep into, you know, X Games or MMA or whatever sport it is, like, even if it's just X's O's in a basketball game, and I understand enough about with the game I'm watching to ask intelligent questions and write intelligently about it, but do I know the game as well as coaches do? No. As well as the athletes do? No. And one of the things I try to do is I just ask people, right? Like, explain this to me, tell me about this. And I think that is that was kind of how I sort of went into the MMA world and writing about Ronda. You know, as a bit of an anthropologist, right? I mean, that's, you know, teach me about this. Let me learn about this. But I wasn't drawn to Ronda because she was a fighter. I was drawn to Ronda as a female athlete. And so the way that the lens that I'm going to view her with is obviously very different than an MMA writer would view her. And plus, they're also covering the day-to-day. They're covering, you know, the ins and outs of the fight and the preparation and why she's talking or not talking. And I thought, you know, that so anyway, let's back up. So that was February, and then she had another fight against Correa down in Brazil. And it was, I think that was in August. And it was, gosh, it was another one. She won by, I think it was 16 seconds on this one. And it was just the things that she said. It was the way she talked and the way she presented herself. I had not heard a female athlete talk like that. I mean, I just hadn't heard and she wasn't just an athlete. She'd become this cultural icon. She'd hit this moment when, I think it was right around the same time Amy Schumer got, it was really popular, and Tina Fey was really popular, and it was this idea of, like, women sort of, you know, not taking it anymore and putting it out there that they're flawed and they're not going to apologize for it, and they're ambitious and they're not going to apologize for it. And Ronda was, to me, this incredible orator of that sort of feminist ideology, right? I mean, it's sort of a new feminism. So anyway, that's what I wrote. That's what I went into the whole story wanting to write about. It really had very little to do with MMA. And then, of course, she loses. And the story changes, right? And then I'm in this role of being the person who was embedded with her and her camp. And I, you know, I think we connected just on a female level, really. I mean, I think it was just, you know, is it really all that surprising that the best female athlete, not the best, but one of the best female athletes of the time would connect with a female reporter, and, like, I would hear her differently than other media, right? And other outlets. I mean, is that all surprising? I don't think so. because a lot of the stuff that Rhonda sort of was working through and dealing with, like, I had dealt with that in my own life and career. So I think the first story was a little more of that, of just an articulation and sort of, you know, who she was and what she meant to the cultural moment, and then what it meant after she lost, right, and how she was dealing with it. And, you know, so much of that story was, you know, I'd reported that for 2 months. I'd been sort of embedded within that camp for 2 months. I went down to Australia, and then when she lost, almost everything I had been doing was sort of thrown out the window. And I did one interview, and, like, I think I turned the story in 2 or 3 days, and we did a quick rewrite. I mean, not rewrite, but a quick edit. And I remember my editor on that piece, Raina Kelly, who's now at the Undefeated. It was, you know, I remember calling her going, oh my God, like, everything we've been talking about is gone. Like, I had prepared so much to do the story. And then she was like, no, the story is better now. Like, it's going to be better now because we see the reaction to it, and we have to capture what that reaction is and what it means. And Raina and I, man, I think it was 2 or 3 days where neither of us slept. We just went back and forth, draft after draft. And in between, I flew to Bristol. Like, we were just sitting in the magazine office for, you know, several days, just finishing that out. So that's story one. You know, when you say it's ESPN-ified, and so that's why I'm giving you the context of how that all was done. It really was just me and Raina doing the story, right? I mean, it really wasn't a lot of people involved in shaping a narrative. This is, people probably think Rhonda has press people and a whole team that's shaping her message. No, like, if there's a team, it's Rhonda. I think the only person, I guess, else would be her. She has an agent, and she has her sister. I mean, those are the people who are closest to her. And, like, none of them told me what to write or what they wanted me to write. Like, this was me talking to Rhonda, and this is what I thought the story was, and what I came in thinking the story was.
Yeah, no, I understand. I was just going to say that, like, maybe ESPN-ified, yeah, wasn't trying to be pejorative there, just sort of, it was mainstreamed, maybe, as opposed to how Luke Thomas would say it, where it's not specific for the MMA.
Yeah, because I agree with. That term, mainstream, of course, because to me, I wasn't writing about the ins and outs of an MMA fight, right? Like, to me, the fight's just a fight. It's just the stage that the action happens. It's just the stage that it all comes about. And, story two, now it's a comeback story. Now it's, okay, where have you been? What have you been doing? How are you approaching this next fight? And this idea that she wasn't talking to any other media, and how she sort of walled herself off from everybody. I mean, that actually became part of the story, right? And I think it became a little more a part of the story even after I wrote it, because I you know, she kept saying she wasn't going to talk to anyone else. But I kind of thought they would, I don't know, I guess I just thought she would eventually, right? As it got closer to fight week and as it got closer to what was going on. And, you know, so I write this story, and I'm expecting she's going to do some fight, pre-fight stuff. And then she really dug her heels in. And I think this kind of became part of her, like, in her construction of the whole event, in her head and the way she was dealing with it, it was like she wasn't going to back down now, right? Like, it was like she's not, you know, she had this idea that she had to protect herself. Like, that's why she lost, that she gave too much of herself to other people and other things that had nothing to do with winning. And that, in her head, sort of only grew deeper the closer the fight got. And I remember I was in touch with her the whole time. Like, she wasn't like, it wasn't like she couldn't talk to anyone. It almost became like a discipline thing. And, you know, if you know fighters, that's everything to them. Like, when they decide they're going to cut weight, when they decide they're going to train, that discipline is everything to them. And I, personally, like, I felt uncomfortable with it, because if I was on the other side of it, if I was the mainstream MMA press, I would be mad too. I'd be like, come on, you can't even face one question. Like, how hard is one press conference? I think I even said something around that. I said, you know, I think you're making things harder on yourself than it needs to be. And she just dig her heels in, and I didn't, you know, it's not my place, right? Like, it's not my place to say anything more than that. Other than to sort of continue to report on the story. I'll say this. I thought it was awkward for me. Like, cause I had just gone through a thing with Mark Cuban, where he didn't let Tim McMahon and Mark Stein into the building, and he had a problem with ESPN and the way we were covering his team. And I actually think that was a convenient, you know, way of for him to explain his actions. I think it had a lot more to do with some other things that were going on than just his, you know, wanting to control the situation. And personally, like, I was really upset about it. I was just like, this is such a slippery slope. We cannot allow owners to make arbitrary decisions like that. And banning one, you know, reporter from coming into the building is like banning all of us. Like, I was really upset about it. And so, I kept checking myself. I kept saying, like, and if you look at the timing of when the Cuban stuff happened and when I was writing the Ronda stuff, it actually was about the same time. And I just kept saying to myself and my editors and you know, look, we have to let the story play out. We have to write it as best we can and try to let her speak for herself and explain herself. I tend to not be that judgmental of a writer. I know that's going to sound, I hope that makes sense, but I would much rather people explain themselves than for me to try to explain them or judge them. Like, you know, going back to the first question you asked me about Lamar Odom, right? Like, I'm at the brothel and like, how am I going to get the best story? How am I going to get the most truth? It's to get people to open up to me and not be judgmental of them as they're opening up to me. So I guess that's my approach to those types of stories. And then back in the editorial process is when you have the skepticism, is when I remember saying several times to all the editors involved here, on the first story, there was an issue with Rhonda and her boyfriend. There had been some accusations against him from his ex-wife about domestic abuse. And I know the UFC had investigated it. They had had a private investigator look into it. He'd been cleared of everything, but it was still a major storyline that needed to be investigated. The questions needed to be asked. And I kept saying to everyone, I really need you guys to check me, because my job is to get people to open up to me and to tell me as much as I can, you know, I can learn and connect to. But then when you get out of the close moment of the access moment, that's when you need the skepticism and you need the editorial review. And so that's why I lean really heavily on my editor on that story, Raina Kelly. And I lean really heavily on I think Jenna Danneby, who runs the Enterprise Unit. I think you guys know each other, right?
We do, yep.
I remember saying to Jenna, I was like, I really need you to keep checking me on this stuff. Because when you do these access stories, like, you're close, right? You're close. You don't see things sometimes up close, right? It's easier to see them from 10,000 feet. It's easier to see them with two or three or four other sets of eyes. And it was the same way on the second story. I mean, I remember saying I was working with a new editor named Rachel Ulrich and Paul Kix was the top editor. And I kept saying to them, guys, like, I've got to call her out. I've got to call her out. I need to be harder on her. Because I'm letting her talk, but now now that we've reported it and written it, I have to be the one to call her out on certain things. And so I went back through on a second, third draft, maybe. And I gave it a much more critical tone in certain spots. Like, you know, look, you are, and I said this to Rhonda too at the time. I said, you know, look, you're a celebrity because you did all these interviews. You're not just, no, this celebrity didn't just happen to you, right? You're not a victim of celebrity. You created a celebrity and then now this is the dark side of it and you're having a hard time dealing with it. I said that to her in person and she gave answers, but just asking the question reads differently than writing it like that. And I think if you go back and read it and you realize how I did have that consciousness and I remember saying to my editors, there has to be a tone where I'm questioning her, in spots and I'm pushing her and calling her out. All I can say is, I tried, right? At least that was my intention. But when the quote you read from Luke Thomas, yeah, I get it. Like, I totally get it. And I got the other side of it. It's a really hard line to walk. But I think at the end of it, the piece you got was a pretty honest reflection of where she was, why she was doing the things she was doing. And it gave you a look into where she was in that moment, right, as she was about to go fight Amanda Nunes. Frankly, the mainstream press could read and then make their own judgments about whether she was going to win or not, and whether this was a healthy mental state for her to be in right before that.
You spent 7 years at the Los Angeles Daily News working mm-hmm. as a columnist and a reporter. You came to ESPN, I think, in 2009. Does that sound right?
Okay. December of 2009. I remember it.
So you've been there 8 years, basically. This will be your eighth year. as we hit 2017. You know, you've obviously, you're in Los Angeles, you cover LA-based teams, but you also obviously cover the NBA on a national level. You do long form stuff. So obviously, and now television and radio too. So it's obviously a great job. But you were recruited to be part of the Vertical when Adrian Wojnarowski was starting that site, and you ultimately decided to stay with ESPN. Why did you decide to stay with ESPN and not go to the Vertical?
You know, I really liked Woj, and I'm always like, I'm a competitor, right? Like, I was a college softball player, so
Stanford with Jessica Mendoza.
Yeah, it's part of the bio, right? Still my really good friend. And it's funny that we work in the same industry because we compare notes all the time. And there's been several times, you know, nights in Bristol where I'll call her and she happens to be there at the same time, and we have a good time at the little cafe there at the DoubleTree. Why did I decide to stay? You know, I think ESPN has, I think it's a, I like the stage. I like the idea that whatever you kind of dream up at ESPN, you can go do. Like, some days, I've always been sort of a generalist. I've never really wanted to be one thing. And a lot of people will say to me, like, you know, you need to pick something. You have to figure out what you want to do, what makes you happy. And I go, no, you know what makes me happy is, like, challenging myself and doing all these things all the time. And I really just like to do great stuff, right? Like, I really just like to, like, challenge, sink my teeth into something and figure it out. And so, God, I started ESPN, and I was just, you know, I was like a local columnist at the ESPN LA site, and then sort of morphed into more of a news person, and then started doing radio and TV, and then I started doing more long form. I mean, it was, I like that I can just follow my curiosity and where it takes me, and then ESPN at least has the biggest stage. There were some things that I really liked about Woj, right? I just liked him as a person. And I respected him as a competitor. I mean, it's sort of like a game respects game thing. So like when we're competing for stories, of course, like, you know, you're competitive, but then when the game's over, I don't know, were we like Magic and Isaiah afterwards? That's why whenever they have those questions about like, do stars need to hate each other? And like, I'm always like, no, you respect the other person. So I was flattered by the discussion, but ultimately, like, I like the fact that ESPN does everything big, or like I had the chance to do things big and create big things that matter. Cause like right now in the world, do you know where we're going to be in 5 years, Richard? I don't,
no.
But I know that we're constantly looking, for stories, for types of content, for types of personalities that cut through, right? Like now, sometimes it's a tweet, sometimes it's just a news story, sometimes it's a video, sometimes it's a long form story. I mean, I'll never forget waking up one morning and like the name Wright Thompson was trending on Twitter. Like Wright Thompson was trending on Twitter because he wrote this unbelievable profile of Tiger Woods. I mean, that's like the definition of cutting through, right? And like when I did the story on Ron, I mean, like, people they'll just remember that, not just because it was a story on her, but it hit this news moment, it hit the cultural moment. It connected in a way that, like, I sensed something that the reason why she connected, she was sort of a vessel for, you know, what, for people to project onto, right? In that moment, with what women were going through in their own personal lives and just sort of a collective struggle. And I felt like between radio and television and all the resource and all the like fantastic people that we had at ESPN, like it was just, that was the stage that I wanted to be on.
You are not management, so I don't expect you to be honestly answer this question, but that's been reported that Adrian is heading to ESPN. There are people who I know around ESPN who believe this to be true. Do you want to, offer any kind of thought on the potential of having Adrian as a colleague, just given the fact that he's pretty much established himself as the premier NBA newsbreaker out there?
I honestly, out of respect for Woj, just the way that, you know, like, I mean, you obviously know I know him and I respect him. I just don't think it's my place to talk about him or his business or anything that you read in that story that came out last week. To me, it's more of a respect thing. And I also don't really know, to be honest. Like, I read the story like everybody else did. But I'll use the old line that a lot of players use with us when we ask questions that they're not, that's not their place to answer. Simply like, you know, I don't get paid to make those decisions, right?
Yeah, it's fair enough.
So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not gonna put the screws to you. That's good enough. All right. Here's something I want to ask you. You're one of the writers out there who crosses over into television. And the transition from going from writing to TV can be pretty jarring. I've had very small tastes of it with spots on CNN and PBS and NBC and some others. But these are basically, for me, one-offs. It's an SI Now is TV, I guess, sure. But it's digital. It feels just different. You've done significant on-air work, SportsCenter, Sports Nation, Around the Horn, et cetera. And here's something that doesn't get talked about a lot, at least in my opinion. From a male perspective, there's always insecurities about going on television. Maybe, you know, unless you're just the super most handsome person on earth or you're a narcissist to the highest order. But you think about appearance because it's different, man. It's just weird to see Sure. yourself on TV until I think it's not. It's very different for a woman, in my opinion, given that whether it's on social media, whether it's producers, it's always more about the physical appearance for women than it is for men. You're not somebody who went into this business to be on TV. You started as a writer and, and television has just come. So what has this been like for you? How have you had to negotiate not just being a byline, but now being a face people see?
Yeah, you know, it's I remember when I did the interview for this job, Eric Neal was the guy in the room and Kevin Jackson was the managing editor of the LA site. And they said, now, how are you about radio and TV? And I said, well, I don't have a ton of experience doing that. I'd done a little bit, like in college, and did some radio stuff. I think I called the year after I graduated. I would drive up to Stanford and I would do the radio broadcasts, right? Because I think I just missed my friends, to be honest. Like the first year after college, I was like, I can still be a part of the team. I'm like the broadcast crew, right? But that was sort of the extent of my experience. But I said to them, I think you've sat with me for about an hour, and I've never really had a hard time talking. The talking part's not hard for me. The TV part is a totally different animal though. There's still parts of me that are like, I can't believe I'm on TV all the time. Cause at some point you learn to relax, right? You learn to just kind of like be yourself and be on, just say what you're going to say. But television is a visual medium, right? Like, and I'm not 105 pounds and, you know, have spent my whole life cultivating a great appearance. I didn't come through the broadcasting world I don't even really know how to do my makeup that well. I'm usually sitting in the makeup chair, like asking, you know, the makeup artists and hairdressers, like, to teach me how to do stuff. Cause like when you're on location, you have to do it yourself.
Right.
And, like I was kind of a tomboy growing up. Like I wasn't all that comfortable with that. I've just sort of had to embrace it and figure it out. And I'm, you know, Sage Deal said to me one time, she goes, you know, I just try to accessorize a little bit, and she'll give me little tips here and there. And she goes, oh, you wouldn't believe it. You know, I used to do the same thing with Jemele Hill. You wouldn't believe when she first started, she was the same way. And now look at her, look how great she is. And so like whenever Sage will see me with like a nice earring on or like nice earrings or necklace, she goes, see, you're doing good. You're trying. Right. And it's funny. Cause like, it is part of it, right? Like there's totally this like comfort level of being on television is not just like putting on makeup and doing your hair. I mean, it's how you look. It's like, if you feel insecure about your weight or how you, you know, what am I doing with my eyeballs there? Why am I squinting? What is my nostril doing? Like I'll watch myself back on TV and run in the other direction. It's like, I can't even watch. Like it's really uncomfortable. Right. Then we haven't even gotten to the social media part when you check. And every time I'm on television, I have almost developed a rule not to check my social media for an hour or two. Cause people just tee off and say the worst mean hateful things. But, I think the best advice I got, was from one of my really good friends in the industry. He's a broadcaster out here in Los Angeles. He's Steve Mason. He hosts the Mason in Ireland show. And
yep.
Radio is one of those things I do all the time just because I really love doing it. I maybe one day I'll do it. I'll do a real show 5 days a week or something because I really love it. But right now I can't commit 5 days a week to something like that. But Mace is, you know, I would tell him, God, I just sometimes I'm on TV and I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, everybody's looking at her going, oh God, if she would, you know, if she would just, you know, learn to, you know, do her hair or makeup better, or if she would just lose 20 pounds, she'd be so good or whatever it is. And he goes, Ramona, you have to stop right there. He's like, if you're thinking that when you're on TV, it's going to show. Like, if you're insecure about things, if that's in your head while you're on air, it's going to show in your performance. He's like, he's been a trained actor, right? Like, so he understands this stuff. It's like, no matter what you think or what you're feeling, it's going to come through. And you have to just own it. Like, when you're out there, because people want to hear what you got to say, and people like your personality on TV, and you connect and you're articulate. Just say what you're going to say and be who you are and just own it. Every time I get insecure, I just hear those words.
Yeah, that's really good advice. We had a guy at Time Inc. who always said, basically, I kind of believe, and again, I don't know if he was just saying this because it's more of a male first female thing, but it always helped me.
Yeah.
And that is, he said, the first 20 seconds, the viewer is going to judge you on your appearance. After that, it's only about your content. So just get out of your head somehow that this is going to be a 5 to 10 minute, you know, sort of thought project on how you look. It's an instantaneous judgment. And then regardless of even how they judge it, they're going to move on. But it is different. It's different for women. I had two agents who were on this podcast, and one of them was very candid about he had told clients to lose weight. He had told clients to get plastic surgery. That's pretty uncomfortable for me to hear, but I appreciated his honesty. And I have friends who work at ESPN who and this is what I want to ask you, who have been told, like, ESPN will send them out to deal with a clothing person, or ESPN will provide them with, you know, sort of more camera-ready tips. That seems so inconceivable to me to do for, like, a writer. Like, and I always wonder, and I'm not trying to knock ESPN here, but, like, are they doing that for Adonde and Windhorse, or are they just doing that for, you know, Woman X?
Do that for everyone.
Woman X is on there. Well, that's,
like,
good.
Think about it this way.
That's good, then.
You gotta look at it, like, totally differently than that, okay? If I'm writing a story, and I have one editor, and I say, what do you think of this? And they say, oh, yeah, it looks great, right? Okay, I want another. I want five people to read it and just give me, like, dig in. Like, I mean, to me, I'm like, you gotta view yourself, like, you know, somebody please watch me and tell me if I'm doing something weird as I talk. If I'm making a weird face, like, tell me, and tell me, oh, hey, next time, you know, try to get your resting face to be different. Like, just tell me. You have to, like, separate yourself from some of that stuff and, like, look at it as a tool. Like,
yeah, that's, I mean, good. Well, listen, can you imagine, I mean, you worked with me once at Sports Illustrated. Can you imagine somebody at Sports Illustrated going up and down, like, sort of giving you tips on how to dress? How amazing would that be? Be the greatest thing ever.
Totally. But, like, if you're going to be on TV,
right,
like, you know, help me. Like, seriously, like, and you have to find a way not to take anything personally like that. Like, I mean, when Sage started telling me, teaching me how to accessorize, I'm like, please tell me some more. I don't know anything, right? Like, you know, or the makeup artist tell me how to put on eyeliner the right way. I'm like, oh yeah, what do you use? You know, like, I need to know this stuff, right? It's the same kind of thing as, like, sharpening your toolbox. If you're going to be on TV, you might as well do it well. You might as well have fun with it. You might as well enjoy it and own it. Like, and I think it's, you know, like, I go back to, like, when I was an athlete, like, you know, if I'm not throwing the ball right, if the spin that I'm putting on the ball is wrong, like, tell me. Or if I'm, you know, when I'm hitting, if there's something, like, the coach can tell me about hitting the outside pitch, shoot, I want to know. Like, and so, like, I'm fine with all of that. I like that stuff. Like, I'm glad that they at least have that. You know, Jerry Madelon was a talent coach, and I remember he would give us, like, tips on body language, like, how you stand. And I always remember, like, him saying this thing about, having the Superman pose, right? Like, some sort of this, like, you know, you, like, stand there, and you kind of, like, you know, get big and you get powerful. And he's like, if you have this sort of powerful stance when you're on set or when you're in the field and doing that, you're going to, like, come across more authoritative and you're going to feel more confident in talking. And I was like, yeah, I love that. So now I also kind of laugh because I like, whenever I do the stance, I just think of it as, like, I'm just, like, a Superman stance. That makes me laugh and relax. And it's, like, ultimately, like, when you, whatever you're doing in life, like, whether it's writing, whether it's playing a sport, whether it's being on television, like, the good stuff comes out when you relax, when you just let it rip, when you let whatever's inside of you come out and really be and just be and own it and be on that stage. Like, so that's always what's in my head. Like, you feel that insecurity and it always bubbles up, and it's like, it's just the same as it was before a big game, right? Like I'm worried about, I don't know, when I was in college, Jenny Finch was on Arizona, right? So I'm like, can I get a hit off Jenny Finch, right? Like, is that, you know, the big game, we gotta win here. I mean, there'd be times I didn't sleep well before games. I was always, I was always on edge and anxious. And then once the game happened, like, it was just a matter of like channeling that the right way. I kind of feel like it's the same thing.
But basically, though, in the end, wouldn't Mendoza just basically bail you out anyway? She'd probably end up like...
Yes, every
like,
time.
What
every
was...
Time.
What was... I wanted
like,
to...
We were always like, 1-0. We're like, come on, Jess. Come on.
What was your career average at Stanford? Do you know?
I don't know that one off the top of my head, but like, let's put it this way. It's not... It's, you know, I remember a couple of radio interviews I did initially. I remember they introduced me as like an All-American, and I was like, no. I was an academic All-American.
Still though, being at Stanford on that campus though, with like so many great athletes, is cool, regardless of anything.
Yeah,
else.
Look, I was obviously good enough to be on the team and start and play.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
I was mostly like the number 9 batter, or like sometimes I'd bat first or second if I was rolling, or if like, you know, I was sort of like a switch hitter, batted right, batted left. I was a really good outfielder, had a good arm. But, like, in terms of the athletic career, like, I was good enough to be on the team.
Yeah,
and listen, play and contribute, not, but,
yeah.
Like, we went to the World Series because Jessica Mendoza was on our
right.
team.
Listen, you're a scholarship athlete at Stanford. That in itself is just unreal. You're already in the top 1%. All right, let's finish up with some questions from readers when I put it out there that you were going to be on this podcast. Peter Bukowski wants to know, when you are writing parts of your piece, he's asking, are you writing in the midst of reporting, or do you report first and then start writing?
Oh, I report first and then start writing. Like, so I know everybody has a different process, but I don't know what the story is until I walk around with everything. Like, I'm constantly talking to myself. I definitely talk to myself. I'm talking to other friends. I'm talking to my editor. I'm talking to whoever it is, like, as I'm reporting. There's certain, like, you usually go into a story with an idea of what you're going to write about, and then you report it, and you decide if you're still in the same ballpark. But I talk it through a story through once, and then very rarely do I nail the first draft, right? I mean, the first draft is almost like just getting everything out, and then I try not to judge those anymore. Like, I used to get upset when people wouldn't like my first draft, and now I'm like, No, this is just my first swing, right? It's like strike one. It's like, let's get it all on paper, and then I'll see what it is. And so, I take a lot of notes, though. Like, I'm constantly taking notes on my phone when I'm doing an access piece, right? Like, because you can't always, like, pull out your recorder, right? And sometimes you just have to take notes of those. I do record a lot, but it's just hard to go through, you know, hours of transcripts, too. And then I oftentimes when I, like, when I really need to decide what a story is, I just like walk around and talk to myself. Like, I'll go for a run all the time. I'll call my mom. I call my mom constantly. She was a writer too. And she still is actually, but, and we always talk the story through. And like, at some point you have to be, my mom always said, you have to be able to distill a story down into a log line. Like if you're going in, to make a pitch, right? You know, you'd say this, it's this meets this, right? And so I need to be able to like distill the story down into like one line. Like, it's just a universal story. It's not even, I don't even use the names. And so like with Kobe, I was, I finally got to this place. I was, you know, this is a man who's confronting his athletic death. And what does he want? He wants his life to matter. Right. Like that's how I have to see the story in a universal frame. And if you can, once you get there, then you can write the story and you know what your through line is.
Producer Lou Pellegrino has called up your Stanford career average. Lou, what is it?
Oh, God.
I bet she's pretty good. Well, not only
it was better in outside of conference than post-conference. Right?
We'll leave it at this. Yeah. Not only was she teammates with Jessica Mendoza, but her batting average was a little bit under the Mendoza line.
Wow.
She batted 197 in four
there
years.
Is.
But listen, Ramona, no one could take away that Stanford education. So you could hit 197, you could hit 971.
She's
really
a good fielder. I remember, I think Ramona told me you were a good fielder too, right? You were an outfielder, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, outfielder. You know what? I actually do have one, I think it's still a record of like getting hit by the pitch in a season, because I was like one of my little things. Like,
nice.
I was really good at that. When I was bat left-handed, I'd always roll into the pitch.
I love it.
To the point where like, I used to get hit so much because I was just trying to get on base. Like, that was my goal, right? Just get on base.
Hey, listen, Ramona's got 477 more at-bats at a Division I school than I have.
Both,
so,
then
Ramona,
both of us
congratulations.
Right,
exactly.
Ramona, this is actually a pretty good question. How do you How do you balance sort of reporting without risking access to a star player who may be petulant or not like reading about himself critically? You're in Los Angeles, so you're dealing with a lot of athletes who get a lot of press, but two, you know, there's a lot of sort of stardom around them. So how do you deal with reporting on somebody who may have who may not particularly always like what you're reporting what you're commenting?
Sure, that's what all of reporting is, right? Like all day long, you're like, how do you get somebody to open up and tell you stuff, right? You have to earn trust, and you have to find a way to get somebody to open up. Now, there's certain interviewers who can get that the first time they sit that person down, and then they just drill away, and there's certain people who can do it that way. I'm more of a long-term relationship person, and so I think my general idea is there's different moments, and there's different ways of telling a story. Like, sometimes you have to be in news mode. You just got to go. Like, you got to write the news story, and you got to write it straight, and it's not a long form story. But there's a need to know and you got to write it. And then other times you take your time with the story. Like I remember doing the Rhonda story and there was a lot of news that was happening, in the moment. And I was, you know, I had to like sort of restrain myself. Like I want to report, I want to do it right now. But if I have this idea that it will be all worth it in the end, that I'm like, I'm going to tell the whole story and the real story in a really powerful way at the end, I just need to let everything unfold. As long as I'm confident that I'm going to do that, like, it's okay. Sometimes waiting, right? It's okay to let things build for a longer piece. It's one of those challenges, and the way you do it is you just check yourself. You call your editor all the time, and you, like, check in. And then, like, how do you balance, like, the political stuff? Gosh, build, like, all the relationships and people's agendas. I mean, you just have to be aware of them. Like, you just have to always be aware of them. And there are, like, certain times where, like, you don't write it right when you have half a story and you're like, maybe I should wait for the other half of the story to play out. And then there's other times where you have to just chip away. Like, I think right now, as I approach, like, what's going on with the Lakers and the Bus family and Magic Johnson, like, there's going to be times where I'm going to let everything play out, and then I'm going to write, there's an idea that I'll wait and I'll write a TikTok about how everything went down. But there's also times where I say, nope, I got to report this right now. This is happening. And so you just kind of have to see the different gears, you know, you have to see those moments, and you have to like understand, you know, when the alarm bells go off, right? And say, got to write it now.
What is a
constant?
What, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What is social media like for you? What is social media like for you in terms of, a lot of your female colleagues in the business, there's a lot of misogyny. If you're black or person of color, you get a lot of race stuff. You're not, I was going to say, you're active on social media, but not as certainly political as others are. So I wonder, what is it, that's a long-winded way of saying what is it like?
I just haven't been able to control myself. who the best advice ever on social media is like, just sit with Michelle Beale. Like, you need to talk to her about this.
Okay? Yeah, she's the best.
She's been in the public eye in that role for years. Like, I think she's had 10 years in the spotlight where she's kind of been the it girl that everybody loves, and a lot of people troll and hate on social media. And so Michelle's a really good friend of mine, and we talk about this all the time, and she's given me a lot of really good advice. And she's like, Ramona, you're not, like, when people say mean things to you, like, you're not a victim. Like, you're not, this isn't like, they're not trying to, you know, victimize you or hurt you or whatever it is. They're just trolling you. You're not even a person to them, right? Like, you're just a figure that they can rail at, right? And like, as long as once you're able to like separate that, like it stings a lot less. And I came back and I was going, Michelle, but like, sometimes the things that hurt me are actually just the things I'm insecure about myself. And she goes, well, that's on you, isn't it? Are you going to give those trolls power over you, or are you going to do it? And I was like, you know what? Totally right. And so I've just tried to like have like a much thicker skin about it, and like just let that stuff like slide off. Like, I don't know why we all do this, but we like, you know, Twitter created this function where you don't have to see mean things or people are saying about you. Just click on the one mention thing, like, and they filter it for you, or just click on only look at your verified mentions. I don't know. Why do we have this like need to like go wound ourselves and hurt ourselves? And I always just think about what Michelle said. It's like, don't give them power over you. Like, don't read them. I was like, you're totally right. Why am I not strong enough to do this all the time? Right. So I'm always hearing that. And I think I'll go back to something even I see with athletes. Like, they get the same stuff we do. Like, I know women in the industry get, like, terrible, you know, comments of us. But go to an NBA locker room and watch a guy after a game click through his Twitter mentions.
Yeah, Jesus.
Like, what do you think they're saying about them? And, like, I think it's probably even worse. I mean, I remember being around Dwight Howard. Like, that ruined him that year in L.A. Like, every year, every game, he'd be on his phone checking his Twitter mentions after the game. And you gotta stop that. What are you doing? Right? Like, and once you kind of realize it's not you, it's them, it is very empowering. And, like, hopefully in another 5 or 10 years, I can be as, like, chill about it as Beetle is. Like, because I think she's great at it.
Yeah, she sort of understands the medium in that way. All right, here's the here's the last one, since I've kept you a while already.
Sure.
Had a lot of people who wanted to know about the Lakers. Lord knows here in New York, we have very little interest in them, but I'll ask it. This is a national podcast. What is your Lakers front office prediction? Whether it's Magic becomes sort of the GM or the decision maker, what happens with Mitch, and will this team see sort of the playoffs over the next couple of years?
Okay, so one, covering the Lakers is like covering the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's great.
It's just sort of, you know, and it's like, I love a good circus. Like, to me, it's,
you think it's better?
Really,
you think it's better
in the care,
better weather than the Knicks? But would you prefer to cover the Knicks or the Lakers if you're talking about, like, just craziness?
I think I prefer to cover the Lakers because of the personalities involved.
Right. Okay.
Right. Like, I don't think there's much joy in covering the Knicks.
Right? No, just read Frank Isola's feed.
It's kind of like, I don't know. I do cover the Knicks too, right? I have to. I'm in that story all the time too, and it's right. Kind of depressing.
All right, so I didn't mean to.
Totally got dragged out.
Yeah, it's horrible. You know? I didn't mean to interrupt you. All right, so Lakers. What do we see?
Like, what's my prediction on the Lakers? You know, I think it's fascinating. Go back to this 1998 story that was written on the Buss Family in Sports Illustrated, and all the characters were cast as, you know, as a sort of like King Lear, you know, as roles in King Lear, right? And you know, the question of that story in 1998 was, will Jeannie Buss, you know, be the victor? Will she be the one at the end, you know, because she's the one who is the most accomplished in business, and she has a degree from USC, and she's, you know, she was sort of the girl who learned at her dad's side. I mean, she was the closest, you know, and her dad would take her to the Board of Governors meetings in New York, and she really learned from him. And you know, Jim Buss did as well, right? Like, but not in the way that Jeannie did. Jim, you know, had a relationship with his dad. They were very close, and they had a lot of traits that were in common, but he wasn't, you know, the same businessman that his dad was, and he wasn't, he didn't go to college and finish. I mean, he did go to USC, but he didn't finish. Jeannie went all the way through and then has business relationships all over Los Angeles, right? Whereas Jim does, I don't think he has that kind of a stature, you know, in the business community. And you see Jeannie, you know, she's out. If you watch her at a game, everybody comes up to her, right? Like, she's sort of the mayor of the team, and she's the mayor of the female mayor of Los Angeles. And so the question for me has always been with her is she going to be the one to take power, right? Is there going to be a coup? Does she have to win, you know, like, and succeed ahead of her other brothers and sisters? Like, can it only be one voice? Or will Jerry Buss's sort of hope of, you know, having the family business pass along to his children come to fruition? Because I know it was important to Jeannie to honor her father's wishes, and I think that's really the only thing holding this back is really just her trying to do right by her father. And I've always wondered, did Jerry Buss set this up, you know, with this idea that if it wasn't going to work out, the most sort of capable, the most noble, the most successful, the most maybe the best leader would eventually seize power,
right?
And this, that very act of seizing power would be the one that means that you were the right choice, right? And so I think that's what's playing out now. And I guess my prediction, you know, when you call Magic Johnson, who has been very close to Jeannie and very critical of Jim Buss over the years, like I don't think that's it's not hard to miss why. I mean, I described it in print the other day as a 6'9" shield, but maybe I was too soft. Maybe he's more like the sword. Maybe he's more like the bad guy. And so I guess my prediction is both Jim and Mitch are either gone or in very different roles next year, or, you know, and things are very different next year, whether Magic's the guy in charge, whether Jeannie's running everything herself, or whether Jim and Mitch Kupchak, the general manager there, are just having to accommodate new people in there. Things are going to change between now and next year.
Is Brandon Ingram a franchise player? I haven't seen enough of him to make that decision.
It's hard to say so early, but I, you know, one person says, maybe he's more like Tayshaun Prince, you know, or another person says, ooh, he could be like Giannis Antetokounmpo, or, you know, because you look at the build and you look at the skill set, and then, you know, when he came into the league, it was, maybe the comparison is Kevin Durant. And I think some of that is just a physical build.
It's just 19, too. So young. Like,
yeah, 6'9", and he's really skinny and 19.
Right,
What I see from him, he seems competitive. His personality, though, is pretty chill. I mean, so is Durant, okay? So I think I'll know a lot more after this year. You see how he responds this year. He sort of seemed to have hit like a rookie wall this year.
Right.
The last month or so has been pretty rough. But I would fall more in the, like, he'll be a Tayshaun Prince type rather than he'll be a Durant type, just based on what I've seen so far. But, like, again, Tayshaun Prince was a heck of a player.
He's
a really good player, and he won championships.
Championship quality player.
That's not a bad thing either.
Right. All right, listen, Ramona, you've given us so much in addition to your career batting average. So it's been a fantastic learning experience. All right, let me run.
Out of all the embarrassing things that could come out of this pod, Richard, like that might be the one I was least expecting.
I feel disappointed it wasn't anything about Woj. It was about your batting average from Stanford. I feel like I failed as an interviewer, but, you know, you can't bat. To use a baseball term, you can't hit 400 every time.
Like, anybody could have Googled my Stanford career.
Thank God it was my producer who did. I didn't even do that. All right, Ramona Shelburne is an NBA. This is officially from the bio. Is an NBA insider and senior writer for ESPN. She's on ESPN.com and ESPN. She's on ESPN the magazine, ESPN Radio, Sports Center, Sports Nation. You see her covering NBA stuff. I highly recommend her pieces. Especially Lamar Odom. That was one of the best pieces I read that year as far as a sports, just fascinating piece. And she's done Ronda Rousey, long form Kobe. And in the future, I'm sure there will be others, particularly Los Angeles-based athletes. I remember Ramona as an intern at SI, and I knew she was going to go on. I didn't know she was going to go on to this kind of.
You did? I don't think I was very good that summer.
No, you were very good. Well, for one thing, we had a lot of horrible interns, so you looked good in comparison, whether you didn't think you were good or not.
Okay.
But you also just.
I think I was a little afraid. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in New York.
You were just intimidated. You were just so professional, which is such a rarity at SI. So I think you were. That's why you stood out. To me, and if I remember correctly, we did talk a couple of times, right? I was not an asshole to you as an intern.
I think we went to a WNBA game.
We did.
I love it. Didn't we go to like a Liberty game?
I feel like we did.
It was something like that because I was at SI for women.
That's right.
The editor at the time was Sandy. Her name was Sandy Bailey.
Now
Sandy
Rosenbush. Yeah, one of my mentors.
She had hired me, and I just loved her, man. I was so green. I think I'd written a couple stories for like the Stanford Daily, and written a couple of stories for the LA Daily News, right? Just as a freelancer and an intern. Sandy was just like, I had never met anybody like her. She was just a firecracker.
loves to curse.
Now she's at ESPN. I always see her as a news editor. It's awesome going back and see, like, she plucked me from the fire. This is like a little bit of weird trivia. I actually applied. You had to apply for that internship at Time Inc.
Wow.
You had to apply through your school. So the Stanford Journalism Department was the one who like selected who they were going to nominate for the internship, and they didn't pick me. I applied for it, and like the journalism professor didn't pick me. I think they picked some sort of like guys who had been doing news for the Stanford Daily and like were a little more serious.
Wow.
And I just said, God, I really want to do this. So I just applied on my own without the Stanford recommendation.
Nice.
And then from whatever vault that went in, Sandy Bailey picked me. And
good.
That's the rest of the story.
Good tip for young journalism students out there.
Yeah.
Sort of go around. You don't always have to go through the formal means. Make your own
breaks. No, you go around them.
All right. Well, you've obviously clearly, you know, you've had a nice little career for yourself, Ramona. You've really made it since those intern days. And we didn't even get into agents. This is the one podcast where I didn't get to talk about CAA, but we'll have to do that on a follow-up podcast. Is there anything else, Ramona, that you wish to talk about before we part ways? I feel bad. You haven't had sleep in like a couple of days.
No, it's fine. I'll go back and go do. I gotta get up and do a little more of an edit on the story I just wrote.
Nice. Well, always working, Ramona.
What else is there to talk Respect about? That. What else do you want to know? What else?
That's pretty much it. I feel like we've covered so much. If I start opening it up, it's just gonna get that much longer, and it takes you away from your day, and it makes my producer have to do that much
and
more work.
And also, my view of podcasts, honestly, Richard, is that they need to be able to be listened to at least in like one workout at the gym.
Yeah, right? I don't think I buy that, but there is that theory. I understand. If it's a good podcast, I feel like you'll go back to it though. That's how I.
Yeah, you'll go back to it. I'll listen to it in the car on the way home from the gym.
But the gym is the 40 minute rule or the 50 minute rule is a very good one, and a lot of people do tell me that they do listen when they're working out. So this will not be one of those, though. I feel like we're over an hour already. All right, listen, Ramona Shelburne has been the guest. Ramona, in all seriousness, it's great to catch up with you. Continued success. I'm really happy to see you doing so well at ESPN. And we'll all be reading you and watching you. Thanks so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, back in the studio with producer Lou Pellegrino. My thanks to Ramona Shelburne, who's really, as I said, gone on to terrific heights at ESPN. And she was an intern at SI for Women a long time ago and total pro then. So you knew that she was going to do something good. But it's great to see her success. Lou, I guess the only thing I would sort of say is, on top of a lot of interesting things Ramona said, was just that Lamar Odom story was unbelievable. And you texted me during the podcast to say that you went to high school with Lamar. I did not know that.
Yeah,
wow.
He's a year younger than me. And
he was a great high
together.
School player, right?
Oh, yeah. When I went to high school, I went to Christ the King High School, and Eric Barkley and Speedy Claxton were the guards.
Wow.
And Lamar was the guy in the middle who just could do it all. And they won the Catholic school title and lost the city championship to Stephon Marbury and the Lincoln Rail Splitters.
Wow.
That was a game. And I mean,
that's amazing. New York City kind of like big time basketball.
Right.
It's
like you hear of like, the legendary New York high school players.
And Marbury's
like
whole
life
was sort of geared towards winning that high school championship because he was such a storied schoolboy kid.
Right.
And wow. So Lincoln Christ the King in that game.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my thanks to Ramona Shelburne and. She is part of what's been a really good sort of like just set of podcasts. First of all, thank you very much for listening. It's just the amount of listens we've got over the last month has just been crazy. I mean, close to double in terms of sort of the average. So people have really liked the roundtable with Jimmy Trane and John Orand. Obviously, Ryan Russillo's podcast sort of, at least in this little world, blew up. So I appreciate his honesty and thank you for listening. Mike Tirico was previous guest before that, and then Jermell Hill and Michael Smith, who just started on the 6 at ESPN. So it's been a pretty good run of podcasts with interesting guests.
And if you listen on iTunes, go and leave a review and a rating, too. Tell everybody how much you love Mr. Deitch.
Or just like say you like the podcast.
Or
so
the
it continues.
Podcast, exactly.
So me and Luke can eat. All right, that's it. I'm talked out. I appreciate Ramona Shelburne and her time this morning for producer Lou Pellegrino, for the guys at Digital Media. For those at Sports Illustrated, Ryan Hunt, Ben Eagle, Chris Stone, and John Wertheim, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.